Okay, so last week we covered a lot of ground, all the way from 1904, Henry Corey's birth, to 1955. He moved up to this area to start a new church. Remember, he had been pastoring at a church in Long Beach in the Los Angeles area, and that's where we're going to pick up this morning. So in Long Beach, Henry had been acquainted with a gentleman named Bill Patapoff. And Bill worked in the steel industry, and he and his wife Marlis moved up to the Bay Area, where they attended the local mainline Presbyterian church. I don't know which specific congregation it was, but one of these, what's now called the PCUSA, Bill and Marlis were members there. And they, at that church, had friends Fred and Betty Jane Holzell. And when Henry moved to the Bay Area, he made contact with Bill, and eventually he ended up inviting the Patapoffs and the Holzells to a summer camp in the Sierras operated by the Presbytery. At that time, the Presbytery was the Presbytery of California. That's how it was organized. And the summer camp was somewhere in the southern Sierras, like, you know, sort of Sequoia National Park area, that direction anyways. And anyways, he brought these two families to summer camp. And he used that opportunity to introduce them to the theology and vision and ministry of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Not long after, those two families committed to becoming the core, the beginning of a core group for a new church plant. The new church, First Orthodox Presbyterian Church of Sunnyvale, started. Their first meeting was on November 6, 1955, at Sunnyvale City Hall. They did not get to stay there long, though, because the city manager belonged to the mainline Presbyterian church. It's very sad. He was willing to use his influence to hinder the fledgling congregation, so they had to relocate. And where they relocated to is the Cupertino de Oro Club, which I'm not sure if it's still organized in that way, but it's near the corner of Homestead Road and Sunnyvale Saratoga, down by the new Apple campus. Ooh, more light, okay. That's where they moved to. It was an old school building. It was actually one of the original Cupertino schools. There was four original Cupertino schoolhouses, and that building was the original, one of those original four, and it had been repurposed as a kind of a club building, and they were able to rent it. And at the time, the area would have been almost entirely orchards. I mean, today it's housing and offices and stuff like that, but cherry trees and all that good stuff would have been the landscape. The church grew quite rapidly. In March of 1956, there were 10 families expressing formally their interest in forming a new church. And actually, around this time, Henry made a brief appearance on television. This is interesting. There was a show called This Is Your Life, and what they would do is they would interview people and kind of introduce characters from their life story. Like they would interview them, find out about their biography, and then they would make a TV show about it. And there would be like these cameo appearances of characters from their story. And it'd be a surprise to the guy who was the main subject of the show. So there was this guy who grew up in West Pittston, Pennsylvania, and he told his life story to the producers, and they developed the show, and they got a bunch of different people to come on the show. And Henry was one of the people that appeared. So there were two sisters living nearby here who were watching this nationally broadcast TV show, and they ended up coming to church. So that's an interesting little detail. You never know what little opportunities one will get. A national TV show appearance when planting a church can't hurt, I guess, if it's the right TV appearance. Other early attenders included the brothers Clarence and Bob Dendulk. So Clarence would later serve as an elder in the congregation, and both of these men went on to be leaders of important Reformed educational institutions. Bob was the second president of Westminster Seminary, California, Robert Dendulk. Every year in Escondido, there's the Dendulk Lecture every year, and that's who that's named after. And Clarence, he went on to serve as a trustee of Covenant College, and he also partnered later with Henry Krobbendam in starting an educational ministry in Africa, in Kenya. I found a news article about Clarence Dendulk surviving the circumstances of the coup in Uganda under Idi Amin. And he seems to be the kind of Indiana Jones among the elders of our church, so he was a pretty cool guy. I found an article, Clarence and Robert grew up in Ripon, at the in the sort of Reformed Dutch Reformed community there, and I found this article by Robert Den Dalk talking about his upbringing and so on. And I guess Cornelius van Til every year, every summer, would come and spend 6 or 8 weeks with their family out in California. And he really liked farming and stuff like that. So he would like live at the farmhouse and go visit the fields and crops and everything. And anyways, Robert Den Dalk has all these memories of Cornelius van Til coming to his house when he was a kid. So that's a little window into the type of community that was forming in 1956. Another future elder, Arnold Larson, started attending at this time with his wife Gloria. And the Larsons were a really big part of the congregation. For the next 5 decades, Arnold and Gloria were mainstays of the church. And DeVette has told me about Gloria's salads. Macaroni salad, is that right?
Jello salad.
Jello salad, there we go.
Or snickerdoodle.
Yeah. And Arnold was the clerk of session for many, many years. So I've read a lot of Arnold's minutes, and I have to say I feel like I've gotten to know him a little bit, and I've enjoyed getting to know him in that way. Very limited way of getting to know somebody. But the Presbytery constituted the church on September 17th, 1956. So that's our official anniversary. We're just over a month away. By the end of 1956, the new church had 32 adult members and 23 baptized children. Now, this next section I've actually shared a little bit before, but I've spruced it up based on what Pastor Herman helped me find. So this is about the church's name. So there's nothing in the church records to indicate the reason for the name. First OPC seems to have been a popular name on the West Coast in the OPC at the time. Corey's own ministry had a first in it. When he became a pastor in the mainline Presbyterian church immediately after graduating seminary, he became pastor back in Pennsylvania of First Presbyterian Church of West Pittston. So that's kind of that old school mainline way of naming a church, just because of the historical context. There'd be like First Baptist, Second Baptist, Third Baptist, First Methodist, Second Methodist, First Presbyterian, Second Presbyterian. And in a bigger town, you could expect to have several of each denomination. And that context just made that way of naming things make sense. It seems to me that Henry was quite a simple man in these things, and it seems like he just preferred to do things in a simple way, not sensational or, you know, he wasn't one of these church growth guys who was like, you know, getting Disney characters to appear on stage at anything or anything like that. I don't know, the church growth movement really got going in the 1980s, but I wonder what precursors there might have been in the 50s. But definitely the name First OPC gives that sense. This is not a sect or a novelty. It's not trying to strike off on some crazy new direction. And actually, that aspiration of representing the continuity of a faithful Presbyterian church, that does come to expression in the Presbytery minutes some years later. In April 1975, there was a big discussion between the OPC and the Reformed Presbyterians about merging the two churches. And the decision about whether to merge the churches included a question about, do we really represent the sort of specific history of the Reformed Presbyterians, or is the OPC really trying to represent the more general American Presbyterian history of Warfield and Machen and Hodge and these guys? And That discussion reveals that at least a significant number of the early generation of OPC ministers really identified strongly with that older kind of mainline tradition of those really amazing guys, Warfield, you know, Charles Hodge, Princeton Seminary. That was their historical roots. I think that name, First OPC, fits with that mentality and that ethos. So it would be nice to interview them, go back in time and interview them and get their private thoughts, but that's as much as I've been able to piece together about how they were thinking about things. So that's the church name. We won't spend too much time on that since we've talked about it before. Then there's the church building, and this is something I found quite exciting. Even before the church was officially organized, the new church was already well on its way to having its own building. In July of 1956, so that's a full 2 months before the church was formally constituted, they already had completed plans for the first unit of a church structure. That's the building that we're in right now, the fellowship hall, as we call it. And by September, so again, even before the actual start of the church officially, they'd already made the final payment on the property. So we'd already had paid off land. It's pretty amazing. God really provided. And it seems to me, I was trying to figure out, how is it possible for it, you know, that's so different from our experience with church plants that go 30 or 40 years without a church building. And it seems to me it probably was because of a few different reasons. One was, it's clearly that this was a very visionary and far-seeing group. They were very motivated to prepare for the future and sort of think big about the ministry that God had given them. And that vision for advancing the kingdom of God was an indispensable element in the success of the church plant. A second thing was, there was a local Christian contractor who was willing to build for less than the normal costs, and that's noted in the records. His name was Harold Camping. I wonder if you've ever heard of Harold Camping. His name will reappear later in the church's history for some other reasons, not altogether positive. A third reason, and I this is my best piecing together a few different things from the records, but it seems that Pastor Corey was able to seek financial support from Reformed friends in the San Joaquin Valley. So we don't know who those friends were. There's a general comment about raising support from the San Joaquin Valley, but remember these brothers, Clarence and Robert Dendalk, they would have been a great example of family connections to establish Reformed churches in Ripon. And we don't know exactly what other connections there might have been, but it seems that God's people, even outside the OPC, were quite generous to helping the new church get started so well. So that's a little window into how things got going. That's one of the things I'm very, very thankful for in our church's history, is that things got established well quickly, instead of dragging on for decades and decades, piecing together solutions to things. That really has set the tone for our ministry in a wonderful way. So 1956 was a great year. Now, the next few years I've entitled Local and Regional Ministry, because what I noticed from the beginning of Henry Corey's ministry here is, remember I shared his missionary strategy was to move into a region, and he had this idea that this was what Paul did in the book of Acts, move into a region, establish a sort of anchor point for ministry, and then use that to build the regional ministry of the church. And you see that happening very clearly at the beginning of First OPC's ministry. So Corey was actually not called specifically to be the pastor of our church. His call was from the presbytery to be a home missionary. And to serve as part of that, he served as the organizing pastor here. But he did combine sort of local pastoral work with regional development and evangelistic work. And one of the early examples of him having kind of both types of ministry in mind is that he led the session in a discussion in February 1957 about starting a summer camp. So on Labor Day weekend, the conference was at Happy Valley, which is near Santa Cruz, and the session discussed this and agreed to take the initiative in organizing it and to recommend it to the other churches in the Bay Area. And remember, only 2 years earlier, Corey and the Patapoffs and Holzels had been at a summer camp where the sort of nucleus of the new church was formed through that fellowship and that time together and that ministry at camp. And so I think this was Henry's idea, that there'd be a new camp in this area that could be a place where people could be introduced to the ministry of the presbytery and the ministry of the OPC, and they could be recruited as potential parts of core groups for new churches. I think that was what he was thinking. And that became, in the 1980s, the annual summer camp at Redwood Christian Park near Boulder Creek. So we still have that camp going, and our session and Henry Corey are actually where that started. So that was a little blessing I discovered in these records. There's another incident, and you'll have to pardon my my rather extreme interest in the details here, but there's another incident that really illustrates the type of leadership Henry Corey was exercising and the church was willing to exercise. There was several churches that they were involved in starting. So the church in Sonora, Henry Corey would travel out there to start the Bible studies. That's how that church started. There was a church in Modesto that he helped to start, right? These are familiar names to us, right? There was also a church in Stockton that he was helping to start. And I think that was the earliest of these. And he was really directly involved in the church planting. And of course, one of the issues that he would need to solve is who's going to preach at this new church plant. And so there's an arrangement called stated supply, where the presbytery can approve a minister who's not the pastor, but he's just approved to be the preacher for a while. Usually in a period of transition at a church. So that's a little bit of the background. And all of this, you see it very intensely in December 1958. On December 3rd, 1958, there was a session meeting. And at that session meeting, the session received into membership Mr. and Mrs. Jack Miller. Does anyone know who Jack Miller is? He's pretty well known for his later ministry. He's most famous as Tim Keller's mentor in church planting. He was teaching it. He was pastoring and mentoring pastoral candidates and so on in the Philadelphia area while Tim Keller was there. And Tim Keller says, "I had a lot of ideas, but it wasn't until Jack Miller sort of helped me put the pieces together that I really had a vision for the kind of church planting that I wanted to do." So he was quite influential in that way specifically, and in several other ways. But he appears in the records here in December 3rd, 1958. So Mr. and Mrs. Jack Miller transferred their membership from First Church of San Francisco, and the context is that at the prior meeting in November, the session had decided to call a congregational meeting to elect two more elders to oversee our mission project in Stockton. So this was obviously an active project for the session. And then at this December 3rd session meeting, immediately after receiving the Millers into membership, the session proceeded to examine Jack and another man for the office of elder. So this is the same session meeting. He was received as a member, and now the next item of business in the record was, we're going to examine you to be an elder. And not only did they examine him, but they certified and nominated him to the congregation at that session meeting. And then at the same evening, there was a congregational meeting. Both men were nominated at that meeting to the office of elder and elected by acclamation, meaning without dissenting vote. So Jack Miller went from being not even part of the church in the morning to being elected as an elder. And not only did they elect him, but actually they proceeded with the ordination service that evening, right there, on a Tuesday evening, December 3rd, 1958. Yeah, somebody said Presbyterian. There was a two-week announcement for the meeting, but yes, not for anything else. So 1 week later, the session met again. This is December 10th, and the newly elected elders, who obviously didn't live in the area, you can kind of tell based on just how things work that they didn't live locally. At that December 10th meeting, they determined that Jack Miller be appointed stated supply in Stockton. Now, my best understanding of the Book of Church Order is that would be the presbytery's decision to do that. So that's another real, you know, a bunch of steps are skipped. So, you know, from morning to night, going from not even a member to ordained as an elder, and then from 1 week to the next, going from church member to, you know, stated supply of a mission work is really, this is quick stuff. So Presbyterians don't always have to be slow. So I wrote up a few thoughts about this. I was trying to think what to make of this. And here's my meditation on it. Presbyterian ordinations do not have a page in the Guinness Book of World Records, but if they did, this occasion would count as the fastest ordination ever recorded. In a single week, Jack Miller went from not even being a member of the church to being ordained as a ruling elder and then appointed a full-time preacher. And it seems to me this was a clearly scripted sequence. The session had already intended to aim at these ordinations when it called for the meeting earlier in November. And when they called for that meeting, one of the men that they had in mind, clearly, was not even part of the church yet. So that's really amazing. And it seems obvious that Henry had probably discussed the matter at length with the session, the congregation, the partners in Stockton, colleagues in the presbytery. None of this could have happened without lots of objections if it all hadn't been worked through in advance. And there's no record of anyone objecting. And actually, in terms of church order, often that's a very meaningful data point. Whether things are done exactly by the book is one question, but if nobody objects, that's its own indication that things are proceeding in an orderly way. in a healthy situation anyways. So it, I would just say it is a meaningful data point that nobody objected to this arrangement, and there's no record of any complaints or grievances or anything arising from it. So it seems like everybody was on board. And my point would be that the process may not withstand scrutiny, even accounting for the fact the OPC's Book of Church Order might be, you know, we know what it is now. I wasn't able to get my hands on a copy from 1958 to find out what the rules were then. It was thinner back then. It was under development in these years. But I think probably no matter what state the Book of Church Order was in, this was probably not done quite by the book. But I would say it's worth considering how Pastor Corey was able to lead this effort so to act so quickly. We often hear Presbyterianism is meant to be slow, but sometimes I think that mentality is a bit of an excuse. How often is our slow pace truly justified in the light of the interests of the kingdom of God? You know, sometimes the Apostle Paul moved pretty quickly, and we don't hear in the book of Acts, oh, Presbyterianism is quite slow. That's not actually an attitude that's modeled for us in the Bible. How often is it even justified to be so slow, even just if we're talking about procedure? We don't always need to act as slowly as we do. Sometimes we act slowly just out of habit or because we haven't really got a big idea or aren't ready to put the work in to prepare for everything. You know, that's something I notice a lot in presbytery meetings and session meetings. If everybody's been talking and figuring things out in advance, then the whole group is often ready to act quite promptly at a meeting. But sometimes we get to a meeting and we're thinking and really like, hey, I never thought about this before, and well, let's give it another 6 months, and that's kind of a default option. And then 6 months go by, and of course, in the intervening 6 months, nobody's read about it or thought about it, and we get to the same point, and somebody's like, hey, I never heard about this. And anyways, it can be kind of overcautious, I think, sometimes. And at least some aspects of church leadership, I think Pastor Corey was a good model of balance. I don't think he was generally rash or hasty in any unwise way, but there were these moments when clearly there was a need that he saw, an opportunity that he saw, and he found a way in the context of the unity of the church to act decisively. And I think that's something that we could appreciate about his leadership. Just, to, you know, this is being recorded, so I want to go on record. I'm not recommending anyone break the Book of Church Order on purpose. Far be it from me to recommend such a thing. Was that clear to everybody? I can pause. Does anyone have any questions? Or are you at all interested in talking more about the details of ordinations? Yeah, Emma?
How big was the Presbyterian congregation at that time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the congregation would have been about 80 people. There were two elders plus Henry Corey, or three elders. The presbytery was less than 10 churches. Or the Northern California part of the presbytery was less than 10 churches. And remember, too, this was a geographically distributed presbytery, all of California, and there's no like long-distance phone calls for free and stuff like that. So the amount of time you'd get to really talk through things, it seems like they did have an idea of, you know, we appointed Henry Corey our missionary, and you know, we're going to march to the beat of his drum a little bit on these things. Of course, I think if he had done something really dumb, people would have had the opportunity to object. But it's significant that in neither the presbytery nor the session, nobody ever raised such an objection. And further reading in the minutes do show that people knew how to raise objections. There's lots of objections to all sorts of things, but not to anything Henry Corey did. So, Pat thinks Henry Corey is my hero, and this is yet another area where nobody ever criticized Henry Corey. Devet?
The church planting stopped
it. Yeah, it lasted for several years. Sadly, it was beset by very serious conflict, and I don't know the details, but there was actually a presbytery meeting where almost every member of the church, it seems, there was about 20 different communications to the presbytery from different people in the church, all writing about the problems that they had with other people. And the meeting went to like 1 a.m., and it included a motion, actually, where somebody in the presbytery moved that the whole body take a 2-minute recess, that everyone present might hang their head in shame. That was how he felt about, you know, the whole tangle of spiritual problems that were being unleashed. So sadly, that spelled the end of that church. That would have been in the later 1960s, I think. Yeah. So some of them ended up at the Modesto Church, and I don't know in great detail what happened after that. Yeah. That may be later in my stack of pages here. Pardon me if I repeat it. Okay, so we're moving into a new period here, 1958 to 1967, and I call this the period of maturing. So the session records reflect a church growing in numbers and organizational maturity. In 1962, the church had 134 members, and the roll stated about that number through this whole period. This would be communing members and children. So just in general, when I say 134 members, that's total membership. That's pretty much what our membership is right now, 136 or something I think we are right now. So just for reference. In 1963, the church determined to stop requesting support as a mission work and become self-supporting. And at that time, the church issued a new call to Mr. Corey as the pastor of the church. Up to this point, his salary had been paid by the presbytery in support of his call as a home missionary. In the new call, the congregation explicitly granted him permission to carry on with exploratory home mission work as part of his local ministry. So that's a generous spirit on part of the congregation to sort of lend their minister to that wider regional work. In 1964, the newly independent congregation began their second building project. Until this time, the congregation worshipped in this part of the building, the fellowship hall, and the second phase was a larger auditorium known today as the worship hall over there. Clarence Dendulk was the contractor, and again, he made it possible to accomplish the work at a very reasonable cost. In 1964, Pastor Corey gave a report in the Presbyterian Guardian, that church magazine, on the progress of the Sunnyvale Church, and his comments give a little glimpse of what was going on. He said that Sunnyvale is the home of a huge Lockheed plant and other flourishing industries with a growing population that now approaches 100,000. For context, the census of this area in 1950 reported a 10,000 population and 50,000 in 1960. So it had grown from 10,000 to 50 to 100 in just over a decade. And today the population is about 150. So in all the years ever since 1960, it's grown by a much slower rate. There are some more comments here that reveal something of the church life. The church's membership comes from as far away as Saigon, South Vietnam, to Washington, D.C. Representatives of the congregation are in 18 different communities nearby and 6 different states, including the District of Columbia, by which I think he means is that people who have recently been members of the church and are still on the rolls have moved out to those various areas. There's a Christian school sponsored by parents in the church, and it's being run in cooperation with members of the Christian Reformed Church and Grace Community Church of San Jose. And that school is attended by 14 of our covenant children. Does anybody know about this aspect of our church's ministry, that we used to have a school? So this is now San Jose Christian School. That school was started by our church, the Christian Reformed Church of San Jose. And Grace Community Church is one of the churches that became Covenant OPC San Jose. It merged into that. So as far back as 1964, we were in a very active partnership in operating a church school. 14 of the children of our church attended. Just as a note, I'm not sure if I put it anywhere in writing, but at almost every, pretty much all, like all the way through the session minutes until about 2006 or 2007 or so, there's various, you know, offerings taken up for the school, opportunities to appoint someone to the board of the school, discussions about helping students attend the school, all these sorts of discussions, distributing literature for the school, all those sort of partnership things. So it was pretty interesting to see how active that partnership was for probably about 40 years. And it seems that some kind of reorganization happened about 20 years ago. And I am not privy to the details. I don't know the details of that. But that was a big part of our church's life for a long time.
Don Jameson was one of the founders of that school.
Yeah, Don Jameson was a principal. Yeah, yeah, and he was an elder for a long time at Covenant OPC. Yeah, Christy?
And I think Amy Harkis was the secretary there.
That's right, yeah.
And with the Key Sisters, wasn't Helen?
Helen was the treasurer, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The Patapos and the Larsons were key.
Yeah, Gloria Larson taught kindergarten at the school. Yeah.
Several of us were board members.
Wow. Amazing. Gloria Larson, at her funeral service last year, there was a whole bunch of people who showed up because she had been her kindergarten teacher over the years. And they were now, of course, in their 30s and 40s and 50s and so on, and had amazing memories of Gloria's ministry to them as a kindergarten teacher. Pat?
It's only 20 years ago, some people here must remember what happened.
Like, I'm not sure anybody really would remember unless they happened to be like on session at the time, and it's something I need to look into, but even the session members I've talked to about it don't have a really distinct memory. It wasn't like we were so actively partnering with them at that time. I'm just saying the notes in the minutes cease about 20 years ago.
Something ceased pretty.
It probably
suddenly.
No, I think it kind of dwindled. Yeah.
It had a major move to their present location about that time.
Oh, okay. That could be it.
I think they've added the high school.
Yeah.
Also, the relationship between the CRC and the OPC changed as well.
Yes. In the late 80s, the CRC started ordaining women as elders, which was a big rupture between the OPC and the CRC, which had historically been very close. So that was sad fact, yeah.
Where was the school located at?
Sorry. Jeannie, yeah?
Yeah, where was the school located at?
It's currently located not far from where Covenant OPC is in San Jose, like kind of Willow Glen, South San Jose area.
Hamilton and Lee.
Hamilton and Lee.
I was asking because when I was at Covenant Church, somebody told me they used to have a school there.
Yeah, they used to have another school right on the property, Grace Christian School, which was very small. Jan Stark was the teacher. Debbie, the CRC is the Christian Reformed Church. Yeah, which was the stream of the Dutch Reformed Churches that was most close to the OPC, especially at the founding. We had a lot of intermingling between those two churches. So some of our Dutch guys, like Cornelius Van Til and people like that, they're part of our history, but they were also CRC men at some point in their lives. Yeah.
The CRC had a large church on Camden Avenue.
Yeah, they still do.
Annually, we had Thanksgiving United service or something there.
Really, with the CRC?
United, we had Thanksgiving,
United,
Festival.
Well, thanks for sharing that memory. See, this is history in action right here. We're we're learning as we go. One little note that Pastor Corey didn't neglect to include. He said, the church building happens to be located one block from a golf course, the owner of which generously permits clergymen to play for free. ruling elders check their minister's score periodically. So there you go. During this period, there were several key people involved in the church's life. Mr. Arnold Larson was ordained as an elder in 1962, and shortly thereafter he became stated clerk, which he continued to serve as for almost 40 years. His wife, Gloria, was a charter member of the church, and there's actually an interesting record of Henry paying some extra visits to Arnold in those very, very early years when Gloria was a member, but Arnold hadn't become a member yet. And the details are somewhat obscure, as they usually are in session records. They don't say exactly what the issue is, but just records that Henry was paying some extra visits to Arnold at that time.
He wasn't a believer at that, she was.
Okay, so DeVette's helping me fill in the details here. So it sounds like Arnold was not yet a believer.
He was a rebel.
He was a rebel. There you go. Well, that, just so you know, that way of putting it did not make it into the minutes. But you can guess there's something like that just from the pattern that you can see. And that investment and ministry to Arnold really paid off, because Arnold became a very important figure in the church and in the presbytery. He was the stated clerk of the presbytery for many years. And really, he seems to have had a very steady presence. Just reading his minutes, I feel like I've got a sense that, man, this man was a rock of a church leader. And there's some very complicated situations that he and others helped to lead the churches through. And it is really a wonderful thing that he served in that way for those decades.
By the way, he had two master's degrees in engineering. So.
Two master's degrees in engineering?
So precise.
Yes. Well, one gets the impression that he was a precise man from his record keeping. Gloria's presence is just as palpable. There's these anecdotes I've shared about dishes she brought to fellowship lunch, the Jell-O salad, and the way she and Arnold welcomed people into their home. One of those people was a young pastoral intern, Jeff Landis, who lived with the Larsons for a season and went on to become the pastor of Covenant OPC in San Jose. Let's see. This next bit I'm going to save. There's a couple other really notable people who were part of the church in the 1960s. And, well, we have 6 minutes. We can do it. Let's do it. One was Dr. Richard Bube. He was a Stanford professor of material science and electrical engineering. Richard Bube was a total intellectual prodigy. He finished his PhD in physics at the age of like 22 or something. And almost immediately on joining the church, he was involved in teaching and he had taken on some leadership responsibilities. And at the same time, there was another important and well-known intellectual, Reverend Rusas Rushdoony. Anyone heard of Rushdoony? And he was attending the OPC Church in Santa Cruz, but he was often here filling the pulpit. He filled the pulpit for the first time in June 1958. He participated in Henry's installation as pastor in 1963. And Mr. Rushdoony was a prominent conservative intellectual, and he and Richard Bube frequently disagreed on matters social, political, and theological. Richard Bube's son Mark told me that there was a proverb about these two men that if Richard Bube sneezed, R.J. Rushdoony would say, "I disagree." They were like oil and water. So in 1964, there's a note that the church held an evening discussion about political matters featuring these two men. Mark told me it was likely Proposition 14 was the issue, which in 1964 was a measure against racial discrimination in housing and was a controversial subject because it meant an infringement of property rights, like you couldn't just rent your property to whoever you wanted to rent it to. And so Bube and Rushdoony took opposite sides of that issue and presented their thoughts to the church. In 1965, there was an issue between the session and Dr. Bube because Dr. Bube subscribed to the theory of evolution in quite a full way. He participated in a scientific publication that advocated evolution and, you know, including the idea that there was no such historical person as Adam and other you know, really major Christian doctrines that he had compromised. And so the session decided that Dr. Bube, it wouldn't be appropriate for him to continue teaching Sunday school classes or anything like that, given that major disagreement. As a result, Dr. Bube decided to move his family to another church. Menlo Park Presbyterian was where he took his family next. And he had two sons in their teenage years. His younger teenage son was a young boy named Mark Bube. And Mark Bube, at the tender age of 12, told his father, I understand that you want to move to a new church, but I want to remain a member of the OPC. Because Mark Bube wasn't, you know, he wasn't messing around with liberalism as a young boy. So what happened was they worked out an arrangement where the Bube family would worship together in the morning at Menlo Park Presbyterian. And actually Henry would drive out to Menlo Park, pick up Mark, and bring him to evening worship every Sunday for probably about 2 years. And for Mark Bube, that was a very amazing opportunity for discipleship, an hour in the car every week with Pastor Corey as a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy. And that was another pastoral investment that paid off handsomely because Mark went on to become the OPC's General Secretary for Foreign Missions for many years. And that's a real legacy of Henry's missionary ministry transmitted on to Mark. There's a specific way that Henry transmitted his missionary gifts to Mark at Vacation Bible School. So Mark would have been about 10 or 11. He was at Vacation Bible School and Henry was teaching the children the chorus, "I am so glad that Jesus loves me." You know that one? But he taught it to them in Mandarin. And Mark remembered that little snatch of Mandarin. And many years later, he said he had an opportunity to address a large group of church leaders in a meeting in China. And of course, most of the talk was being translated. But at one moment, Mark was able to sing, "I am so glad that Jesus loves me," in Mandarin, you know, to the local crowd, which I think was quite a surprise to everybody. And was an example of the fruitfulness of that early ministry in Mark's life through Vacation Bible School. Around that time, though, Pastor Corey's ministry in Sunnyvale was drawing to a close. In 1967, he was recruited to become the next pastor of Calvary OPC in Glenside, Pennsylvania, which is one of the flagship OPC churches, especially at that time, but even still today. It's right across the street from Westminster Seminary. And actually, Mark Bube is there now as an elder. He's there all these years later. Henry pastored there for about 4 years, and in 1971, he wrote a reflection upon his retirement, and he retired from, he was never the full-time pastor of a church again after 1971. This was his full, his sort of permanent retirement. But with a grain of salt, because for the next 20 years he was involved in helping churches get started, and there were, I think, at least two more churches that he helped to plant, but never as the actual organizing pastor. So here's what he said in 1971, looking back over 40 years of ministry. He said, "When I look back to 1931, when I was ordained in the Old Presbyterian Church, USA, I'm filled with wonder at the greatness and glory of the everlasting gospel. Against the shifting sands of man-made theological and philosophical systems, how impregnably stands the towering breakwater of God's truth." And Corey moved back to the West Coast. He continued to participate in presbytery leadership. He was the moderator for a time, stated clerk of presbytery for a time, and eventually he settled in Southern California, where he helped to plant El Camino OPC in Goleta. And I think one other church, I keep meaning to go back and double check, but I think there's one other church that he helped to start during his, quote, retirement, as so often ministers struggle to totally retire. One final note for today. On June 9th, 1973, Mark Bube got married, and he and Kathy were married here at the church building at First OPC Sunnyvale, and he invited Pastor Corey to come back and officiate the wedding. So that was a kind of fitting tribute to his childhood pastor, and another little legacy of Pastor Corey's ministry here.